We're continuing our series on life, death and resurrection, and we're into a part of this series now where we're looking at various passages that we haven't looked at before but are quite relevant to our subject, and for some reason or other we just haven't looked at them. And I'd like you to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Now, it's often said that amongst Christian circles, and you'll often hear it particularly at funerals, as many of these phrases that we've come across come up at funerals, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And in other words, once a Christian believer dies, it is said that their soul then goes to be with the Lord in heaven. Now, I think over the last few weeks, we've really looked at a number of statements that are quite contrary to that. So I'm hoping that I'm kind of preaching to the converted here tonight in that respect. But that's really the phrase I want to look at, and in fact the passage that surrounds it, which says something quite different. And we'll do something like this over the next few weeks. We're going to look at some people who are said to have gone straight to be with the Lord at death, or they've gone to be with the Lord, such as Elijah, possibly Enoch. We might have a look at Enoch. And maybe the thief on the cross, who, remember, the Lord said, "This day I say to you, you will be with me in paradise." But that's further down the track. So just some reminders. Of course, a person doesn't have a soul. A person is a soul, or a being. We've looked at that from Genesis 2. I hope you're very familiar with what we're talking about here. And the other verse that goes against a person being straight with the Lord after their death is that we read that the dead know nothing. There is no work, device, knowledge or wisdom in the grave. That's from Ecclesiastes 9. And of course we looked a number of weeks back now at 1 Corinthians 15, which talks about resurrection. And so resurrection is a very important part of God's scheme of things. Anyway, we'll look at the verse in question and then we'll read around it. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and the verse particularly in question is verse 8, and I'll read it from the NIV. It says, "We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord." Or I think as the New King James or the King James says, something like absent from the body and present with the Lord. Absent from the body and present with the Lord, yes. Now, if you've got a bookmark, you should put a bookmark in there, because we're going to go away from that a few times. If you need a bookmark, I've got one here, if anyone wants one. Good. Let's just get something straight out of the way first. This is not a formula that says to be absent from the body is to be present from the Lord. That phrase is taken. Yes, that's right. Some people say to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. But that's not even a quote. I mean, it's based on this verse, but it's not even the correct quote. Because the way I've just said it sounds like a formula. It's just a statement. It's a statement of doctrine. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. But that's not at all what it's saying. This is Paul saying that he'd prefer to be with the Lord. Let's read it again. "We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body," or to be absent from the body, "and at home with the Lord," or at present with the Lord. He would prefer to be. And we'll read some other verses around that. In other words, he wants to be clothed with a new body. He wants to be clothed with a new body because not only will he have a new immortal body, this new improved glorious body, but it means that he will be with the Lord because he was either been resurrected or he's lived through that time when he was alive but the Lord came during his lifetime and his body would have been transformed. And we know that didn't happen, but that was certainly the hope in the Acts period, and that's when 2 Corinthians was written. So this formula is shown to be quite wrong in another passage of scripture, I'd like you to turn, keep the bookmark there, but I'd like you to turn to 1 Thessalonians 4. Yeah, what we're going to do in a moment, once we come back from this, is that we're going to read that whole passage, about the first 8 or 9 verses, and then we're actually going to go back and read further back and further ahead. So, yes, that's right. Verse 6 is very much tied in with what we're saying here. What I just want to show you here is that this, the idea of a Christian dying and then going to be with the Lord in heaven straight away is refuted by this particular passage here in 1 Thessalonians 4. We'll read from verse 13. Paul's writing again. This is an Acts period epistle again. He says, "Brothers, we do not want you to be ignorant about those who fall asleep," in other words, those who have died, "or to grieve like the rest of men who have no hope. We believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him." In other words, those who have already died, who are in Christ, he will bring with him at his second coming. Verse 15. "According to the Lord's own word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left till the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God. The dead in Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive and are left," so Paul's, I think, expecting to be alive when the Lord returned, "after that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air." And here's the crunch part of it. "And so," or if you like, "or in this way," or "thus," I think the New King James says, "thus we will be with the Lord forever." So he's saying that's how it happens. Not once a person dies they go straight to heaven, but they have to wait until at least the Lord's second coming and that resurrection. That's how a believer will be with the Lord forever. Now, I know we've talked about the timing of resurrection, and perhaps it could be different for us. I tend to think it will be at the Lord's coming, but I accept there are other views about that. But certainly for these people, that was their hope. That was how they viewed that they would be with the Lord forever, not immediately upon death. So the idea of being absent from the body, immediately present with the Lord, wasn't something that these people knew about. All right, I'd like you to go back to 2 Corinthians 5 now, and we're going to read a number of verses around that particular verse. Verse 8 was the one in question. We're going to read some of the verses that lead up to that. Verse 1. "Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed," in other words, the earthly body, "we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands." All right, so there's another body prepared. Verse 2. "Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling." All right, longing to be clothed. And this was Paul's hope, that he would be clothed with this different body. "Because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked." And that's an interesting phrase there. When we're clothed, and he's talking about clothed with this new body, this new dwelling, we will not be found naked. Now, I'd like you to put your bookmark there again and go back to 1 Corinthians 15, just a few pages back probably. Because that word naked turns up in another verse that's to do with resurrection, but it may not appear as the word naked in your translation. See if you can pick it up. The verse in question is 1 Corinthians 15, verse 37. So I'll read, now that you're in 1 Corinthians 15, 37, I'll read the verse we just read in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 3, says, when we are clothed, talking about the new body that we're going to expect to get, when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. Now, that word naked is the word gumnos in Greek, and it's in this verse here, verse 37 of 1 Corinthians 15. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or of something else. Where is it? Where's that word? Where's that naked? Yes, well, what translation are you reading there?
NKJV.
All right, so Hassel's reading the New King James Version, and it says, but a mere seed, or something like that.
Grain.
A mere grain. In the NIV, it says, just a seed. Just a seed. It's the word naked. It's really saying a naked seed. Or then the King James says, a bare grain. A bare grain. And what's that contrasted with? Well, it's contrasted with what it grows into. That's right, yes. Verse 37, when you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed. Just a picture or something that's just a fraction of what the final outcome's going to be. Perhaps of wheat or of something else. Verse 38, but God gives it a body as he has determined, and to each kind of seed he gives its own body. And so it's really, it's contrasted with being clothed here. It's contrasted with what we can expect, this much more glorious fulfillment, if you like, of what we're intended to be. Yes, mature, that's a good word. The final product, what we can hope for, what we are designed for. The body we have now is fantastic. We all acknowledge that it's a magnificent piece of machinery, but it's not really quite how it should be in the end. And after resurrection and to immortality, it will be. All right, if you go back to 2 Corinthians now. Yes, go ahead.
It's not what it should be, is that what you said?
There's nothing wrong with the way that God designed it. That I did say that, yes.
Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with the way that God designed our bodies, mm-hmm. but I don't think we were designed to just be this mortal or this in this way. After the Lord's resurrection, he was given a glorious body. It could appear and disappear. It seemed to have other qualities which he didn't have before. I think there's probably other things there too. He was certainly immortal, so he took on immortality after that. That body took on immortality, if you want to put it in that sense. There seemed to be something light and shining about it too. We read that those phrases come up a few times, and I think that's what we are intended for. That's the goal. But at the moment, we have to go through this first life with this body. It's tainted with mortality and Adam's sin and our own sin thrown into boot, and it's just not quite what it should be, magnificent as it is. It's the seed compared to the fruit, to the fully mature fruit that it's going to be.
But we're not talking about our human, which is the seed for us.
Right now, the body you're in.
The
body you're in right now is the seed. It's just a fraction of the magnificence of that will be.
Yeah, I think wouldn't it be more correct to say that Paul is only using an analogy of seed. I don't think he's saying that our new resurrection bodies grow from this one.
Yeah, that's right.
No, that's true.
But this body, the point he's trying to make is, this body has to die. This has to go.
Yes.
To be replaced by the new one.
And yet, what I gather from this passage in resurrection, 1 Corinthians 15, and elsewhere, when we look at this subject, is that there is something that ties that new body with the old body in the form it is. Somehow, I will still be identified as David.
Right, yes.
It's not as if we're just given something that is so completely different from this, you know.
No, that's right.
Hmm.
We'll be recognised.
I think it'll be vastly improved, but there does seem to be something that ties, there's a link there which ties that new glorious body with something of what the old one was.
When we were talking about the judgment, when we talk about being resurrected and then being judged, part of that, you have to remember what you did wrong.
Well, we're now getting into another area here. It's a very interesting area. Whether that body and resurrection will be able to remember what the person did in the first life. Yes. It's an interesting, I don't want to get too far into that just for the moment. But what I'm trying to do here, folks, is tie up in 1 Corinthians 15 how it talks about the seed that then grows into maturity, into a fruit or a cob of corn or something like that, right? And here in 2 Corinthians 5, Paul's using the same word, naked, that we use to look at the bare seed or the mere seed. He's using the word naked, and contrasting it with the body that we will be clothed with. He considers in this sense that we are naked. We are poorly clad, is perhaps a way to put it. We are not fit at the moment. Alright? That's the idea. Alright, let's go back to 2 Corinthians 5. We're just reading through this passage leading up to the absent from the body, present with the Lord statement in verse 8. And we're just reading through some of the verses. We're in 2 Corinthians 5. And I hope you'll bear with me. I'm going to read from verse 1 again so we get the context of all that. Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in... I'll just start again. Verse 1 of chapter 5. Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. Meanwhile, which is now, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, because when we are clothed with that heavenly dwelling, I've just inserted those words, we will not be found naked. And naked was the same word we read in 1 Corinthians 15 about the bare seed, the mere seed. Verse 4. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling. So that what is mortal, which is what we're in now, may be swallowed up by life. So that what is subject to death may be overtaken by a body that is not subject to death. Let's put it that way. Verse 5. Now it is God who has made us for this very purpose. See, there's that idea of purpose again. The seed isn't the end product. It's the fruit is the end product, the desired product, the goal. Verse 5. Now it is God who has made us for this very purpose, and has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come. And there's a very similar thought. We won't look at it now, but it's in Ephesians 1, verse 13 and 14, where we are told that we are sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise. It's the same sort of idea. Verse 6. Therefore, we are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord, or absent from the Lord. It's like verse 8, but from a different perspective. We'll just read it again. We are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. In other words, while we've got this present body, we haven't been resurrected, or the Lord hasn't come so that our bodies have not been transformed into like his glorious body. Verse 7, we live by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. Because If we're away from the body, from this present body, it means that we will have been resurrected or at least transformed, which means immortality. We'd prefer to be immortal and in that state rather than the state we're in at the moment.
And then you've lost that curse of death.
Yes, that's right. The curse of death has no more hold. And we're looking forward a little bit to another part of the study, but I think we should read verse 9, because I think this is really the whole aim of this passage. It's not really to give us a biological thesis here, but it's so we make it our goal to please him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it. All right, we make it our goal to please him, whether we're now or later. We'll come back and read some of those verses in a while. I think it's really helpful to ask yourself when you're reading anything in the scriptures, why is this written here? Why is this written here? And the answer to the question in the epistles is almost always one of two answers. That particularly the epistles, you either read, apart from personal remarks and comments and, you know, send my cloak with Titus or whoever. Two reasons. The passages are either addressing a commonly believed mistake, so in other words, the people who are receiving the letter are thinking a whole lot of balderdash, and Paul or whoever's writing it is putting them straight about it, or it's an exhortation to walk the Christian walk. And that's what I think this is. Even though we're reading a whole lot of doctrinal statements about the body here, and some prophetic statements in a sense too, what's going to happen in the future, it's really all in the context of walking the Christian walk. And so much of the epistles are written in that context. This part we've just read in verses 1 to 8 is actually part of a much larger argument. And I'd actually like us to go back to the previous chapter, and even then we're kind of cutting in a bit, but to chapter 4, verse 5, and we'll read through some of this this argument, because it gives the passage that we've just looked at a bit of a setting. All right. Just before we do that, I'll just give you a few thoughts, and then as we read, hopefully these will be highlighted. So far, what we're doing, we're looking at that phrase that's often said, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, which is actually part of 2 Corinthians 5, verse 8, but it's not really a quote anyway. That's not exactly the way it's quoted. And I'm suggesting that this is actually part of a much larger argument, and it starts a little bit earlier, and we're going to pick up our reading from 2 Corinthians 4, verse 5. And it really gives us a setting. It reinforces the fact that Christ died for us and now lives. But the two thoughts that come through here are that because he lives, we shall also live with a new body. That's one thought. Because he lives, we shall also live with a new body. And then the next thought is, therefore, let us live for him and not ourselves, because he died for us. All right. In other words, while we have this present body, we aim to please the Lord. Let's read some of these verses and we'll see how it goes. Verse 5. Breaking in the middle of an argument here as well, but anyway, verse 5. For we do not preach ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. Now, just before we go any further, that word we is going to turn up a few times in this passage, and very often in epistles we talk about we this, or the Lord has done something for us, and it's talking about Christian believers as a whole, or perhaps that a church as a whole or something like that. In this instance, I don't think it is. It's really talking about Paul and his co-workers who have a particular ministry, and then it's going to be contrasted with the people in the church, in other words, these Corinthian readers. So just bear that in mind when we read that word we. It's not Christendom in general, it's not all Christian believers, it's Paul and his co-workers. Verse 5, for we do not preach ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. Some of these statements are rather difficult, but just try and get the general tenure of what he's saying. Verse 7, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay." I like the way that that's put in the NIV, jars of clay. "We have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. So then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you." So again, he's talking about his own work, his own ministry, the way that his life was constantly endangered, and through that he's hoping that the Lord would actually be glorified, and that that would actually lead to the salvation of many and the life of the people he's ministering to. Yes. Pretty well just what I said. I'll see if I can say it a different way. Well, firstly, Paul is mortal, but he is subject to... his life was on the line all the time. Have you got chapter 6 there? Got chapter 6 open? Verse 4. Now, we read a number of times in Paul's epistles about some of the things he went through, but here's a little summary. He says, "Rather, as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, in great endurance, in troubles, hardships, and distresses, in beatings." Right? These are all the things that he went through in order that he could carry out his ministry for people just like the Corinthians. "Imprisonments and riots, in hard work, sleepless nights and hunger, impurity, understanding," and so on and so on. That's the manner in which he does it. But he's, verse 10, "Sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. Poor, yet making many rich." That's not a bad way to put it. That's a different way of saying, what was it, chapter 4, verse 12? "Death is at work in us, but life at work in you." That's the general gist of it. I find the Corinthian epistles quite hard to read sometimes. I think they are actually some of the hardest of all the New Testament epistles, because Paul has these rather... lengthy arguments, and some of the way that he phrases things are not always crystal clear on first reading. Yes, they take a bit of unravelling sometimes, and this is just one of those.
But who's the us and the you?
Us here is Paul and his co-workers. Read verse 11 and then see if it makes sense. "For we," that's Paul and his co-workers, "who are alive, are always being given over to death."
Yeah, that's literal death.
Yes, he was putting his life on the line. He was imprisoned. I think, isn't there one passage where Paul becomes unconscious somewhere and then he just gets up? He was that close from death however many times. And so were his co-workers. So verse 11, "For we," Paul and his co-workers, "who are alive, are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake," so they're putting their life on the line for the ministry of Christ, "so that his life," the message of his life, the life that can be found through Christ only, the resurrection, all of those things, "may be revealed in our mortal body." So then death, those aspects of death, that threat of death, if you like, is at work in us, but life, as a result, is at work in you, in the Corinthian people. It's a difficult way of saying it. I mean, I struggle with the actual grammar of these verses particularly. But that is the general tenure of what he's saying. We the co-workers are putting our lives on the line for the ministry of Christ, and the result is that you are being blessed. You're receiving life through Christ, through the things that we're saying and suffering.
And their suffering is like, I guess, a credibility.
Yes, yes it is.
Prepared to go through these things, it sort of gives credibility to their message.
That's exactly right, Phil, yes. Credibility, and it just went with the territory of being a Christian in the first century who was going to go and do this sort of work, because Christians weren't always the most popular people in the Roman Empire in the first century.
Question. Why isn't life at work in Paul and his co-workers?
He doesn't say it isn't.
No, but he says death's operating in us, life's operating in you.
But how many other times has he said that we have life through Christ? He only wrote it in 1 Corinthians, a year, 6 months earlier, about the life through resurrection. Just because he hasn't given his whole theology in that verse.
How would he say death is at work in him? Just the suffering that he endures, the possible death.
That's what I think it is, yes.
Because
that's where he says in the previous verse, we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake.
He says it in verse 11, for the disciples and him and his co-workers. For we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus may be manifest in our mortal flesh.
Mm. Yeah, so Janelle's got a different version there, but yes, saying the same thing. All right, let's keep reading now, verse 13. Good questions, good points to clarify. Verse 13. It is written, I believe, therefore I have spoken. With that same spirit of faith, we also believe and therefore speak. In other words, we believe this, so we just have to talk about it. Because we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus from the dead will also raise us with Jesus and present us with you in his presence. Now, that's an interesting point, because remember the subject of our talk tonight is absent from the body, present with the Lord, and trying to dispel the myth that when a person dies, when a Christian dies, that they go straight to heaven to be with the Lord. Well, here, Paul's saying something very different to that. He says that he talks about being raised in the future. Not just going straight to heaven, but he's talking about resurrection. And in case his Corinthian readers didn't know, well, he just wrote a whole chapter of it in the previous letter, in 1 Corinthians 15, about being raised and how that raising would not take place until Christ's coming. Remember, each one in his own order. Christ the first fruits, then those who are his at his coming. So there's no thought here that a person dies and goes straight to heaven. That they wait for resurrection for these things to take place. Verse 15. All this is for your benefit, so that the grace that is reaching more and more people may cause thanksgiving to overflow to the glory of God. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, and I think we probably all know that feeling, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. And I think some of the translations there talk about the outward man dying or wasting away, yet the inward man is being renewed or refreshed. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen, what is still future, what is still yet to be fulfilled, is eternal. And I'm going to keep reading here, even though we've read it already. Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked, or when we have that proper clothing, we won't be poorly clad. We won't be like the seed, we'll be more like the fruit. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed, or ill-clothed, or improperly clothed, but to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. Now it is God who has made us for this very purpose, and has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come. Therefore we are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. In other words, while we're still in this body, that future goal hasn't been fulfilled or come to pass yet. We live by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body, or absent from the body, and at home with the Lord, or present with the Lord. Again, I want to stress that he's saying he'd prefer to be that. It's not a doctrinal statement. To be absent from the body is to be absent, is to be present with the Lord. But he's saying he'd prefer to be with the Lord. So we make it our goal to please him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. Now, bear in mind, of course, the Corinthians were believers. They were Christians. Their salvation was secured. So this judgment seat of Christ that he's talking about, we must all appear before, is not a judgment of the world, which I think has to do more with that second resurrection after the millennium, but this is one for believers. They have to give an account of themselves. And as far as I can see, I can't see anything elsewhere that contradicts this for our own calling, that I think we will also have to give an account of what we do. I like the way it says here, while in the body. In other words, while in this body, you've got X amount of time to do things that are pleasing to the Lord. Once that body dies, that's your chance over. You know, you then have to give an account for that at resurrection. Verse 11. There's just a few more verses, about another five verses, and then we'll move on to something else. Since then we know what it is to fear the Lord, we try to persuade men. What we are is plain to God, and I hope it is also plain to your conscience. We are not trying to commend ourselves to you again. They're not preaching themselves, but are giving you an opportunity to take pride in us, so that you can answer those who take pride in what is seen rather than in what is in the heart. In other words, that Paul's putting him and his co-workers up as an example to follow. Have pride in the way that we've lived and the things we preach, not in us as mere human beings. You can put it that way. Verse 13. Now, here's where it gets really complicated, and I don't intend to spend a lot of time on these next two verses. A lot of questions are going to come up out of this. If we are out of our mind, it is for the sake of God. But if we are in our right mind, it is for you. There's a number of theories about what this means, but I think it might be a reference to Paul's critics actually referring to him as mad. I think he appeared before, always get these two mixed up, was it Felix? I think it's Felix or Festus. I think it's Felix. And Felix says to him, yes, much learning has made you mad, or lose your mind, or something like that. There's actually a passage in the Gospel, someone accuses the Lord of being out of his mind because he's talking about things that they can't understand. And just after that, I think the Pharisees start saying, oh, he's of Beelzebub, and so on, in Mark chapter 3, if you want to follow that up. But I think that's really what it's saying here, it's a reference to Paul's critics referring to him as mad. If you want to have a look at 1 Corinthians 12 some other time, you can do that, but I think there's a similar passage there. And then verse 14 throws up another one. For Christ's love compels us, because we are convinced that one died for all, and therefore all died. Now it's an interesting statement, therefore all died. I want to read 14 and 15 together, because I think whatever that phrase, therefore all died, means, it is at least given some light in the next verse. Verse 14 again. For Christ's love compels us because we are convinced that one died for all, and therefore all died, and he died for all, that those who live, and this is the contrast here, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. So whatever that all died actually refers to, and there's probably about three or four different possible interpretations there, I think it actually refers to everyone. To Christ died for the whole world. You know, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son. But then it goes on to say, but whosoever believes in him. So he died for the whole world, but then that smaller group, whosoever believes in him, shall have eternal life. I think the principle is the same. Because it's verse 15 talks about those who live should no longer live for themselves. Well, that doesn't apply to everyone, does it? It's really applying to those who to whom their faith is found in Christ. Look, the whole point of reading that far is really wrapped up in that last phrase of verse 15. That those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. And that is really the setting. When we read about absent from the body, present with the Lord, Paul wants to be that, but it's all in the context of, you know, the Lord has died for us, therefore we should live for him. That's the whole point. I don't want to go too much further, but perhaps, you know, well, I've already mentioned this about if Paul is actually saying that we go to be with the Lord immediately upon death, which I don't think he is saying that. If he is saying that, it goes against what he wrote in 1 Corinthians, which was only written a short time before, how there is an order to resurrection and that it comes after Christ's coming. So death is never spoken about as a ticket to be with the Lord. If you can think back to when we read 1 Corinthians 15 a few weeks back, it's never spoken about as being this great gateway to heaven. It's always spoken about as a hopeless situation, something that has no exit except through resurrection, which is all God's doing, it's not ours. And I think that's a really important point to make. There's a little booklet down in that pile called Death, No Gateway to Heaven. It's a little red one there. And that's the whole point, that death is not an instant ticket to heaven. It's resurrection leads us to our other life. Now, what I want to do now is related, but it's quite a different subject too. I want to talk about the phenomenon of near-death experiences, just for the 15 minutes that we've got left. Because what people, you know, this is what the sort of thing that people say, some people say anyway, that they've died perhaps on an operating table or in some rather strange circumstance. They believe that they've gone to heaven temporarily and then they come back to tell you what they've seen. You're familiar with the sort of thing? Okay. All right. Well, there's actually been a number of studies carried out on this. And again, we might refer to the two scientists in the room. Can I call you scientists? They might have something to contribute here. But a number of studies have been carried out on what is often called the near-death experience. Firstly, let's just clarify what we're talking about here. Sometimes, and particularly Christians, so this is really the point of why I'm bringing this up, there are a number of documented cases. Many Christians report having died and then gone to heaven, and they see all sorts of things there, but then they come back and then they come and tell what they've seen. And I've actually got three books here, just three I picked up within about 5 minutes of each other. I think the titles all give it away. Return from Tomorrow is one of them. These are all written by Christians who died for some in different ways, they died, they had visions of heaven, and then came back. So this one's called Return from Tomorrow. This one's called My Glimpse of Eternity. This one's called Caught Up into Paradise. What I just want to talk very briefly here. I don't want to get into a whole lot of scientific language, which I won't be able to understand for a start. But I just want to give you some observations that have been noted by people who've done a lot of looking into this. Firstly, near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, by the way, they're called OBEs, if you want to get an OBE, you have an out-of-body experience, are physically seen and felt by people. They're quite physiological phenomena. Some people will imagine them just purely because they want to imagine them, but there are a number of sensations that go along with this. The following is a selection of the most commonly reported phenomena from people of different cultures and religions. This is what they report. They have said that they feel a sense of peacefulness. They hear unusual noises. They travel through a tunnel. They will have out-of-body sensations. Not everyone will have every one of these, but these are the most commonly reported. So that out-of-body sensation, they might be able to see their dead body below. So they might float above the operating table and look down at themselves. Seeing a light is a very common experience. Entering that light, and then, well, there's all sorts of other features. And that isn't just from people with a Christian background. That's people of all sorts of cultures. And the point I want to make here that I think is interesting, this is one of the second observations, is that near-death experiences and experiences like that differ from culture to culture. In other words, what people see and experience differs very much whether you were born in Australia or whether you were born somewhere else. And what I want to do is just give you some very brief, and they are very brief, examples of what I'm talking about. You would expect that if, in a Christian tradition, if someone dies and they have an experience, then they're either going to go to heaven or they're going to see hell. I mean, or purgatory perhaps. Those are about the only three options from a Christian perspective. But that's not what happens. Just let me read you a couple here. Here's a man from Chile. He's from a Mapuche tribe. In his near-death experience, he journeyed into a volcano and encountered dead relatives and a German man who seemed to be in charge. What we get from this after a little bit of investigation is that he lived in an area that was surrounded by volcanoes, right? So he's very familiar with that particular landscape, volcanoes, and the history of his particular people was dominated by German colonizers. So they had a German tradition. So what's he see? He sees a volcano and there's a German man in charge of this particular place. Here's another example, a bit closer to home, about an Australian Aborigine, an Aboriginal man. Well, he met traditional spirits, and so he saw the turtle man spirit. Now, I don't know too much about the turtle man spirits, not part of my heritage, not part of my experience, but he knew it, part of his experience, part of his heritage and culture, and that's what he saw. He didn't see heaven, he didn't see hell, neither did the man from Chile. Buddhists. Some studies have been done about near-death experience amongst Buddhist people, and they often encounter dead relatives. And it mirrors the fact that Buddhists revere their ancestors. You know, there's often little shrines to the ancestors. Not sure about Hindus, didn't read about that, but I would suspect there'd be a similar phenomena. And this one's interesting. A little bit of background here. I think I'm right in saying that the world's population is made up of about 51% female and 49% male. It's not exactly 50-50. There are more women than there are men. 51% female, 49% male. And in most cultures, people who report seeing relatives in their near-death experiences about 60-odd% report seeing women. But in India, they don't. In India, it's been documented that many family members appear in near death experiences, but only 23% of them are female. And you may or may not be aware, but India is an anomaly in this instance, is that I think there's something only like about 47 or 48% female and 52, 53% male. And it's a sad fact, but it has to be said, that having female children is not always desirable in Indian culture, in traditional Indian culture, and accidents happen. But what I'm trying to say here is that the culture very much affects what these people see and the experiences they have. So these people who've written books about their experience of going to heaven have strong Christian heritage and Christian background. So what do they see? They see Christian images. What do Buddhists see? They see Buddhist images. What did the man from Chile who lived near the volcanoes see, who had a history of German colonization? He saw volcanoes with a German man there. And I think this really does go to emphasize that what these people see, it's very real to them. There are physiological things that are at work in the brain, but essentially they are having hallucinations. They are seeing things that are not genuine. They are not visiting the afterlife. They are not visiting people who are alive and talking to them. And we know this from scripture because, once again, as I remind you, the dead know nothing, and there is no work, device, knowledge or wisdom in the grave. So they can't be seeing dead relatives. Firstly, they're not conscious themselves, and if by some means they were, then they wouldn't see their relatives who are also conscious, because there is no consciousness. Okay?
What does it say about Kerry Packer's culture that he saw nothing?
Christians have gone and seen nothing. Kerry Packer saw nothing, didn't he? He said, I've got good and bad news.
Yeah.
There's nothing on the other side, or something like that.
He didn't know he was supporting scripture.
That's right. That's right. I don't know what his background is. He may be atheist. I'm not sure. Who knows? I don't think your religious persuasion, if I can put it that way, is necessarily going to determine what sort of near-death experience you have. But you'd have to imagine that whatever you feel strongly about is going to come up in those images, in those times of when the body's performing extraordinary deeds, and the adrenaline's rushing and the oxygen's perhaps a bit low and all those sorts of things. I just want to finish up with one other observation. So the first observation is the sorts of things that people see about going through light and so on. The second observation is that near-death experiences differ from culture to culture. And the third observation is that effects like going through the light, hearing voices, going through a tunnel, these sorts of things can be instigated by other means other than dying. We get people reporting these experiences or experiences like this in instances where they haven't actually died. So they haven't crossed over to the other side. They haven't crossed over into the afterlife to experience some of these things, and such as seeing the light and travelling through tunnels, hearing unusual noises. And I just want to give you a couple of instances about this. The first and most obvious means of producing some of these experiences are drugs, hallucinatory drugs, like LSD or marijuana and a number of others. They can all produce these sorts of experiences. I don't know too much about this one. The scientists might help us here. Temporal lobe epilepsy especially produces out-of-body sensations. Here's another one. Electrical stimulation of the temporal lobe during brain surgery can cause a sequence of events that include out-of-body sensations, bright lights, unusual noises.
But it could also be the humming of the machinery, because the lights emit a hum, and so does the suction equipment.
So they're taking some information, but not all of the information. Yeah. Let me just finish a couple here, and I'd be interested to hear more of what you've got to say. Here's another situation. Changes in blood gases, such as oxygen deprivation, high or low carbon dioxide, low blood flow to the brain, loss of consciousness, which can be produced by all sorts of means. And an interesting one they bring up here is G-forces in pilots. You know, when pilots, if they take a dip or they, you know, the various forces at work on their body are quite extreme sometimes. And you might have seen they have those experiments where they put them in a chair that's a bit like a ride you might see at Luna Park, where they swing them round and round and round at very high speeds to see when they're essentially when they're going to become unconscious, and to see what a sort of effect they have. Because if they conk out at a very low level, then they don't want that person, you know, piloting a plane or a particularly a jet fighter or something. And these people who've been in those test chambers have experienced the very sorts of things we're talking about: seeing the bright lights, hearing different noises, going through a tunnel. Exactly the same thing that is often said to be a sign of having travelled across to the afterlife. Okay, I think that's probably enough. And there's a number of others if you want to read up on that. Just to conclude here, I want to say I think the near-death experience can be a real phenomenon, even physiologically speaking, but where it should differ for us is the interpretation, what we actually make of those sights and sounds and things that are experienced. And of course they're often seen as being a glimpse of the afterlife, but of course that promotes a sense that we don't need resurrection. And if we don't need resurrection, we don't really need God. And the world's very happy to embrace that. Very happy. All right. Do you want to just say anything before we finish up?
Just one thing about that is that with those near-death experiences, the people may be technically dead or, you know, clinically dead, but they're not completely dead. And they're not dead for 3 days and then come back. They're not dead for a day and a half and come back. They're dead for a number of minutes, sometimes up to 20 minutes. But if you're dead for 20 minutes and you've got no oxygen happening in your brain, whatever you come out with
won't be the same anyway.
So, you know, the fact that it's only a short space of time should tell you that it's a physiological phenomenon. It's not a spiritual thing.
And to me, the expression near-death experience, to me it implies that they're not dead. Near-death. Otherwise it would be a death experience.
I think the implication there is it's a short way of saying near-permanent death. So in other words, that they have died by someone's reckoning anyway, but then they've come back again to live again for a few years until they die for the final time.
Generally it's one, you technically die in terms of your heart or your lungs or your blood flow. And then if you're going to actually die, all the rest of the systems collapse within a fairly rapid period in a minute. But sometimes if the heart just stops and you've got a fair amount of oxygenation in your blood, you can live until they, you know, put the paddles on and they start you up again. So it's only one system failure. But when all the systems fail, that's the time when they're dead, and then there's no response, and you know all of those sort of seven signs.
It sounds to me as though a lot of these experiences could be explained as just having an incredibly low pulse rate. Because you're dying between each pulse, aren't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
Because what?
You're dying between each pulse.
Yeah, that's good. Heart's at rest, you are technically dead.
Yeah.
Contract, rest. You're technically dead there. Contract, rest. But we don't spend our life
in this. But one of the things you said to me, I think today or yesterday, was that some of these other sensations that people experience in that position is perhaps due to an adrenaline burst too.
The adrenaline and the endorphins and the auditory hallucinations and the visual hallucinations are so real for people that, you know, they actually, you know, I think they experience
on,
them
they?
As...
No,
but it's because their bodies and their brains are shutting down.
Anesthetic can do really weird things to people too, which goes into the drugs.
People will tell you in anesthetic they have an out-of-body experience where they sit up and watch the thing, but that's part of the drugs, what the drug is doing.
Yeah.
Because it's remember, when you have a drug in your system, it either heightens or it decreases your senses. So if it happens to actually heighten your senses, you're getting information from every nerve in your body, and so you could actually imagine what was happening in that operation. But they also talk about nightmares, dreams, especially the new anesthetics. They don't kill you in terms of your lungs. They have no impact on your lungs, which is a good thing. But they do give you very wild, wacky dreams for anywhere between 6 and 12 months. And if you have dementia, they make the dementia worse. That's why some people can go into an operation perfectly fine and come out the other end of their total knee replacement with dementia, because of the drug. It's an allergic reaction.
Okay. Did you want to say something there, Rathel?
Yes.
Before we finish?
Yeah. To go back to the earlier segment about the body. And
absent from the body, present with the Lord, which is why I brought up the near-death experience. Because people will often say, oh, well, I've experienced this. I've been absent from the body, gone to be with the Lord. And now I've come back to tell the tale. Yes?
And I'm interested to know what your reaction is. I don't know whether you've read it or not, but Custance says that he believes that if Adam had not sinned,
hypothetically.
It's a bit silly to talk in the ifs and whats, but nevertheless, I think it's an important point. He says if Adam had not sinned, he still would have had to have been transformed before he could go to heaven, or because flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom.
I totally agree. I absolutely agree.
And he likens what would have had to have happened to Adam to what the three disciples saw happen to the Lord on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Who? To the Lord or Elijah and Moses?
To the Lord, no. Because he was transfigured.
Yes.
In effect, he showed them what his resurrection, what his state and glory was going to be like.
Those sort of examples are few and far between, but we've got to get everything out of them that we can, because they're the only information we have really about resurrection. Yes, I agree. Adam was created a marvellous being. He was very literally, I think, in better physical shape than any of us here. He lived to be 930 odd years, so he did okay.
That's after his sin.
That's right, after his sin too. So he must have been in good nick. But yes, I believe he was still a seed.
Yes.
He was a seed, he wasn't the fruit.
No, as glorious as that body, it had to be changed.
Yes, I agree with that.